A few weeks ago, the state of Ohio punished a man named Dennis McGuire by taking his life. McGuire's execution, carried out in response to an admitted rape and murder of a pregnant woman, was newsworthy. It was newsworthy for several reasons, but one of the more pressing reasons that it made the news was the method of his death. For some time now, in deference to the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment, states wishing to kill those convicted of certain crimes have been compelled to do so by lethal injection. Because the European pharmaceutical companies that supplied these key elements for the so-called three-drug cocktail have recently stopped selling their drugs within the United States, refusing to be made complicit in what they view as an inhumane punishment, prison authorities in states that practice the death penalty have now turned to untested means to kill prisoners. In the case of Dennis McGuire, the mix of chemicals intended to kill him first appeared to induce what is known as air hunger, a prolonged struggle for the air that is not being supplied the body due to the reaction of the drugs. It took 25 convulsing minutes for McGuire to die, and the nature of his execution has once again called into question our collective practice of state-sponsored killing. Alongside the discussions around the unequal usage of this penalty and the lack of efficacy in actually changing criminal behavior was the not-so-subtle current that was retributive anger. For some in this conversation, deserving to die was not enough, and McGuire's suffering seemed to offer satisfaction for this. One of those voices that I cannot get out of my consciousness, who weighed in on McGuire's death, was a columnist in Oklahoma named Jeff Mullen. At the close of an article about McGuire's execution, Mullen wrote, "It took Dennis McGuire more than 15 minutes to die, and he undoubtedly suffered a fearful, painful death. But don't expect me to feel sorry for him." For Jeff Mullen and many others, that McGuire died was not enough. Not enough when held up against an abiding anger that courses for many. In the past week, there has also been a fair amount of derision around the state visit of President François Hollande of France. Now, state visits are as formal and as dignified as it gets. The seating chart is intensely scrutinized. Toasts follow a choreographed, strict protocol. Every detail sends a diplomatic signal. And since the only other previously scheduled state visit, that of President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil, was canceled over the United States National Security Agency's recently documented wiretapping of her private conversations with her aides. Whoops. This state visit with President Hollande of France was le big deal, and was made even bigger, though not for issues of national security. For President Hollande was not accompanied on this trip to the United States for this official visit, as he and his girlfriend of 7 years recently ended their relationship amidst revelations of his taking trips on the back of a Secret Service moped to see another woman. Now, this was coming after a lack of clarity that already existed as to whether this former girlfriend actually counted as a first lady, since they were not married in the first place. And all this has meant that the press in France and much of the world have been enjoying a field day with this. I suppose it's because even though this is a story as old as stories have been told, this telling of it seems to have a particular French twist, but there's something underneath it as well. It's as if the high-profile nature of this scandal has also served to elicit our collective inner church lady. Right? Well now, isn't that special? Quickly followed by, thank God we can point the finger at him. Or maybe at others. You may have read the news a couple months ago about the divorce settlement of Rupert Murdoch and Wendy Deng. After a 14-year marriage, they have officially parted ways, and prenuptial agreements kept the proceedings to a minimum, but it was reported that Deng will live in the penthouse in New York City with their two elementary-aged children and receive the mansion in Beijing, while the 82-year-old Murdoch will get the estate in Beverly Hills, a vineyard above Bel Air, and nearly all of his $13.4 billion. What is unclear is what is next for Deng or for Murdoch matrimonially, right? Because you may not know this, but it was only days after his previous divorce was finalized that Rupert and Wendy were actually married, lo, these years ago. And so as you can imagine, the headlines were large and lurid, at least in newspapers that Rupert doesn't own. What's not to want to read all about when a divorce settlement involves penthouses and possibly controlling stakes in one of the largest media companies in the world? Especially if there could be another missus in the making. So what do Dennis McGuire, François Hollande, and Rupert Murdoch and Wendy Deng have in common? Us. You and me. Or to redirect a bumper sticker often seen around Berkeley, if you're not feeling uncomfortable yet, you're not paying attention. Because in our gospel for this morning, another portion of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, not only does Jesus choose to teach the law, he attempts to make very clear with some graphic language that the letter is not enough, that the spirit of the law must be obeyed as well. It's not enough to avoid murder, adultery, and indifferent divorce. From the looks of things in the world around us, Jesus does this for good reason. Maybe we revel in the missteps of others because it gives us a certain sense of security to point the finger at another who has so clearly transgressed. Well, at least I haven't done that. And maybe you haven't, says Jesus. But that's not the sum total of right living. That's not what it means to choose life in God's holy realm. In fact, that's just the beginning. Because living a kingdom life is not simply about refraining from severely damaging others. It means that, right? I mean, our families and our communities are littered with that evidence. But what Jesus is pointing to in this gospel is so much more challenging and demanding and is deeply counter to our culture. Because as much as it is clear to us of the damage that is done by these dramatic breaks in relationship, ultimately it is the subtler fractures of our hearts that are myriad and affect not only the relationships we hold with the people around us, but they deeply affect our innermost being. And these subtler breaks are often easier to hide, aren't they? Right? We become adept at hiding from ourselves and masking the effects of anger, lust, or indifference. I think that's why Jesus uses these harsh words to expose us to the dangers of our interior intentions. Being left for dead in prison, tearing out one's eye, cutting off one's hand. These should be shocking images to us. But I believe that Jesus is using this hyperbole not to have us take these actions. I haven't even seen the most fanatic literalists follow these words, but instead to get our attention. So he says, Again, do not murder, but it's not just about murder. It's not even simply about physical violence against another. It's about what we do with anger itself. In order to live a full, whole life, we cannot hold on to our anger, cursing another in our heart. As I've quoted before, carrying anger is like taking poison and expecting the other person to die. Unreconciled hostility slowly but surely corrodes us. He continues. Again, do not commit adultery. But it's not simply about sex with your neighbor's husband or wife. No, this is colloquially what is known as the Jimmy Carter verse. Right? Jimmy Carter was given great grief for acknowledging his own sin of committing adultery in his heart many times. The grief that he got was not just for admitting this in public. My guess is he's not the only one. But also because to some it seemed to be not something worth worrying about. But again, if choosing the life of this kingdom of heaven of the here and now is about the well-being of all, looking on another person as an object for our own use, be it of fantasy or of manipulation, serves to fracture both that person and us. And if unchecked, over time, it inevitably leads to disintegration and to death. And the last, divorce. In ancient society, like much of human history, men held nearly all the financial and legal power over women. It's only very recently that this has begun to change. And so this iniquity was certainly the case in that first century. A man could divorce his wife with a simple certificate of divorce, thereby removing his obligation and freeing himself to pursue another woman. His wife, then, was often left destitute, forced to rely on the possible mercy of her family of origin. And so Jesus says, if what you're after in divorce is another woman, that's not what life in this kingdom is meant for. To follow this law, to live in this realm, we cannot be indifferent to our responsibility for those who are vulnerable. Choose this way of life, challenges Jesus. For as one theologian has written, you cannot come to God when you devalue another person whom God has made. Or to paraphrase Mother Teresa, we often fail to remember that we fundamentally belong to one another. We fundamentally belong to one another. All of us, whether we like it or not, and often we don't, both in word and deed, action and intent, not just for that other person, but for ourselves. Because the wholeness of each of us, the wholeness of a person, the wholeness of the people is ultimately what God seeks. Friends, always remember that the Gospels were written after the resurrection. Our actions and intentions may be to the contrary, may often be to the contrary. But God wants nothing more than for us to choose life today.